So, Manisha, at dinner last night, you were actually pretty excited and maybe even a little bit giddy about this topic, how to build a better budget. Why?
I was. When the conference said this year, by popular demand from requests in the audience, what people are interested in hearing about is how to be more savvy spending your money, the hair stood up all over me and reminded me that I needed to shave my legs. But the reason that I am so excited about budgeting is I think it is one of the most powerful levers that you can control in your life, and most of us are viewing it incorrectly. In other words, you've probably heard the analogy before, but when you're trying to lose weight, you have really two levers. You can eat less and you can exercise more. And when you're trying to get financially fit, you can spend less or earn more. And in this economic environment, I want all of us to be earning more. But the power that comes from also being really mindful with your spending at the same time and having a rock solid budget is enormous. It's literally the financial equivalent of, you know, when you're struggling with your weight and you just diet or you just exercise, it feels like you're going nowhere. But when you combine the two, it's more than one plus one. It turbocharges it. And if you can earn more money, which is a key component of this wonderful conference in terms of us stepping into our leadership potential, combined with strategically spending a little bit less in certain areas of your life, you will be amazed at what happens. And the last thing I want to say about this is, what are we doing wrong with budgeting? I think the key thing is budgeting feels like deprivation. I mean, as soon as you hear that word, I don't know about you, but my stomach kind of contracts. And it makes me feel like somebody's put me in a straitjacket and they're trying to take away my happiness. And I read a book back in the early 1990s that totally changed my viewpoint on budgeting. And it was a book called Your Money or Your Life. And the root premise of the book is this. All of us, unless we got really lucky and inherited it, we earn our money because we go to work. So we are exchanging our life's energy for that money. Therefore, when we spend that money, what we are spending is our life's energy. And so the process of budgeting is not about depriving ourselves at all. The process of budgeting is simply maximizing our life's energy, making sure that all those hard hours of work, when we spend them in the form of spending money, are going to the things that make us the absolute happiest. So that, to me, is what budgeting is about. And in this session, we'll give you lots of different tools and ideas on how to build a better budget. But I think that mind shift might be the most powerful thing that you can take out of here. Not deprivation. This is empowerment, maximizing your joy. That's why you budget.
And so it's really not deprivation. It's a platform almost to financial freedom. As long as you take the step to be aware, which is sometimes half the battle. If you're writing down things that you're spending, sometimes we're too afraid to do that. So it can really be a platform to be freeing.
It can, and we'll talk about some of the mechanics later, but one of the examples that I just want to give right off the bat of budgeting is, you know, oftentimes people will tell you to track your spending. And so you can track your spending, and when you go through, you'll often find things that you spent money on that didn't bring you any joy at all, like drinks out with people you don't even like, food that's making you fat, gym memberships that you don't use. And so the process of budgeting is not about, the intent is not to strip away your joy. The intent is simply to optimize so that you are getting the maximum amount of happiness for each one of your hard-earned dollars. So if you can think about the whole conversation we'll have here today in that framework, hopefully your hairs will stand up too next time you think about budgeting.
How would you classify the nature of an average person's finances today?
Oh, so I have some interesting stats that I wanted to share with you, and I wanted to share them because one of the things that I have discovered, I'm 43, I've worked in financial services my whole life, and I meet so many people that feel privately ashamed or embarrassed about the state of their finances. And so I share these numbers simply as a reference point to hopefully, if you are feeling overwhelmed or as if you're struggling with your finances, to know you're not alone. So just some big level statistics. If we were an average group, all of us ladies in here today, if we were an average group, 76% of us would be living paycheck to paycheck. So 77.6 out of every row of 10 people, 7.6 of us would not be able to meet our bills after 3 months if we were to lose our income. For those of us that have credit card debt, the average credit card debt that we have outstanding, if we were a typical sample, would be $7,000 in credit card debt. For those of us that have student loans, the average student loan, if we were a sample population, would be $30,000. And there'd be a 1 in 8 chance that we would have over $50,000 in student loans. And interestingly, there's an 80% chance that we have not tracked what we need or identified what we need in order to save for retirement. And as a result, there is a 45% chance that those of us in this room will not be on even remotely close to being on track to managing, maintaining our standard of living in retirement. So those are grim statistics, but I want to highlight that they are the norm. And so if you're hearing them and you are feeling tension about your own situation, what I find about money, we as humans and particularly as women, we will share so many other aspects of our lives with our girlfriends. It could be marital problems. It could be mental health problems. It could be problems raising our children. But we often don't share our financial problems. So I also wanted to frame up at the start of this conversation, we are here to help you maximize your joy. And if you are feeling tension, you're not alone.
Is it true that men outnumber women about 2 to 1 for saving for retirement?
Yes, Cal, they do. And I think there's a couple reasons for this. Guys chit-chat about money. We chit-chat about guys. and so it doesn't mean that they are better. And the studies actually show that we women are better. When we learn the basics, we are better at saving. We are better at investing. We're very detail-oriented. We're good at multitasking, and we're disciplined. I think part of the root problem is that historically, a lot of the language of finance, I call it male speak. And I have kind of an interesting anecdote around this. So I've always looked young for my age, which is a horrible thing when you work in financial services. So all through my 20s and 30s, I'd walk into a room and somebody would assume that I was the D team, and I could just see the eyes rolling, and you know, I'd be waiting for the coffee orders. But now that I've gotten a little older, it's interesting. My wonderful husband is 19 years older than me. And when we are out socially and I am with his friends, they often assume I know nothing about money. And so they'll start talking to each other. And I am not kidding you. It's like they're speaking pig Latin to each other. They don't know anything about money. So it's not that men are better than us. They just engage in this dialogue earlier on and not necessarily with good results. So yes, Cal, you bring up a really big point, and one of my personal missions is to help women feel like money is our language too.
Why is it so hard? We have an audience full of power women here. We're competent, intelligent. Why is it so hard to start budgeting and saving, do you think?
So I have kind of a long three-part answer. The first reason, I think, is that most of us were never taught the basics of personal finance. And if you stop and think about it, we went to driver's ed. And my generation didn't get out of high school without learning typing. But nobody, well, very few of us, received a formal personal finance education. And we are the first generation where that really matters. And this is why. When our parents were growing up, there weren't a lot of financial products out there. There weren't a lot of choices. There were societal safeguards that saved you from yourself. And by that, I mean, let me give two simple examples. You wanted to get a mortgage. When my parents got a mortgage 40-some years ago, they literally had to go down to the bank stare the loan officer in the eye, explain exactly how they were going to be repaying that money, and put on their Sunday finest to talk to him, because back then it'd be a him, and their only choice was a 30-year or a fixed-rate mortgage. They didn't have an alphabet soup of adjustable-rate mortgages and interest-only mortgages and other things to consider. Or even credit cards. 40 years ago, it was not easy to get a credit card. Now we can go to the mailbox in our PJs and on most days find an application. And so there's been this proliferation of choice, but nobody gave us an education on how to select. So I think that's really the first of the 3 points that I would highlight. The second point is that we don't have a lot of time, and it's the rare woman that I meet who, if you say hello, doesn't say, I'm crazy busy. And in the absence of a lot of time to make a decision, studies have shown, there's this famous jam study where they have one table that's got like 4 jams and one table that has 40 jams. And consumers walk by. The table that did the most sales at the end of the farmer's market was the table with a handful of jams, because the brain cannot process so many choices. That whether it's jam or financial products, it's a human response to shut down to too many stimulations. So that's the second reason. We didn't get an education. There's too many choices, so our brains genetically shut down, male, female, everyone. And then the third one, and this may be of the things I say today, this may be the other game changer. So I'll take a deep breath before I say it. We are bombarded 24/7, 365 by the most ridiculously unrealistic media images. I am a sucker for Law and Order reruns and all the medical shows and the legal dramas. And if you turn them on and look carefully, you will notice that every single policewoman, nurse, and paralegal is showing up to work at 7 or 8 in the morning with a full blowout and a mani-pedi. And the level of grooming that we see, it's stunning, and it extends past that. You see their homes. You see the clothes they have. And I have a hunch that if somebody were to do an economic thesis on this and add up the cost of what it would take to maintain that average lifestyle, you'd have to be earning 25-30% more than those jobs pay. So it's like we're staring in this crazy funny mirror and we're trying to keep up with what we're told is average, but the math doesn't work. So Kelly, that's why I think it's become such a problematic topic when you strip it all away. It's not because of the math. It's the other issues.
And that makes sense. And you spoke a lot about the inordinate amount of information out there. Talk a little bit about the misinformation on there. And I know from having been on your blogs on Money Zen that you talk about the myths and the misinformation. What are maybe some top three?
So I like to talk about savings myths. And my favorite one is, I can only save a little bit. It's not even worth it. And the way I think about it, it's if you're leaving the house in the morning and you're rushed, would you say to your child or your spouse, sweetie, I only have time for a quick hug, so I'm not giving you a hug. Savings is a lot like this. It's another example, it's like dental floss. I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but I actually didn't start flossing regularly until I was in my 30s. And from that point forward, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, how could I have not done this? And it's the same thing with savings. The reason you start saving on, and I don't care if it's $5 a week, it's building the muscle. You will be amazed once you start building the muscle in a small step. Serendipity and the universe kick in. It's really eerie how this happens. And suddenly you'll start finding ways to save $10 a week, and then $25, and then $50, and suddenly you're up to $100 a week, and now you're really cranking. And it builds from there. And so the key thing, it's with any human endeavor, is just to start. Small is hugely valuable because it starts building that pattern, that muscle. So that's really the first myth that I'd highlight. Another one that I'd highlight is, and Kelly and I have talked about this one in the past, it's this notion of I will save more money when I make more money. I hear this all the time. I have kind of two lives. When I'm wearing this hat, I do financial literacy advocacy work and sharing the message of financial empowerment with women so we can own our finances. But in my day job, I run a wealth management firm, and I manage money for a very elite group of individuals, people with $1 million to $25 million in assets. And you would think, if somebody's got that kind of money, they have no problems. But I have met people who, even at those levels, because let's just say you're making $500,000 a year. Well, if you spend $600,000 a year, you're in the same place as making $30,000 a year and spending $40,000. It's called a dark hole. And so what I find is when people start making more money, this thing called lifestyle creep kicks in. And the best way to describe it is you go to this store and you get a great new top. And you get home and you think, man, I got to get some new jeans to wear with this. And so then you go buy the jeans. And then you need accessories. So you buy a new pair of shoes and a handbag. And then you get in your car and you think, I look so fine, I cannot be in this car. So then you got to get a better car. And then you drive home and you're thinking, this apartment, this house is not working with the car and the outfit. And so it just keeps growing, and it's called lifestyle creep. And the reason it's so insidious is that in years past, we used to compare ourselves horizontally to the Joneses, to our neighbors next door, who pretty much, because 30, 40 years ago, those societal safeguards kept us from spending more than we made, lived within their means. Now we compare ourselves to the rich and famous, not to the Joneses, to the Catherine Zeta-Joneses, vertically. And so our viewpoint of what is reasonable and what we're benchmarking against has become skewed. So any amount is a perfect amount to start saving. And to say you will start saving when you make more money is the financial equivalent of saying you'll start going to the gym after you lose weight.
You've taught me a lot about the Joneses, and don't worry about keeping up with the Joneses because the Joneses are broke. And my neighbor, I have a little seven-year-old girl, and our neighbor must be going through a midlife crisis. He pulled up in a new Porsche, and there's all these bright new shiny toys and the boat with the jet skis and all that. And of course, she'll remark, and I'll tell her. I said, he just has a boatload of debt. You don't have a boat, mm-hmm. It's a boatload of debt. So thank you for everything that you've taught me there. I wanted to ask you about another myth that I hear quite a lot about in my field. Do you have to be rich in order to have a trust? What if you have kids?
Yeah, okay, so here, let me answer that. That's a great question. I want to answer in two different ways because it raises an underlying question of what should you give your kid? What level of spending relative to your children is healthy? And so let me frame it up this way. The Department of Agriculture is The Department of Agriculture is the governmental entity that tracks how much it costs the average American family to raise a child from 0 to 18. And likely they were the department that did it because for years the biggest expense way back when they got that duty was probably food. Fast forward today, where parenting involves so much more than just feeding your child, and the average cost of raising a child who was born this year to 18 is over $200,000, and that's before you add in higher education, and that's for an average upbringing. And there's been supersizing in what we feel is appropriate or necessary to give to our kids. And I see this particularly with women because we care and we love. And so knowing the fine line when it comes to raising kids between what is empowering and what is enabling when it comes to money is huge. And this is becoming an increasing problem because for the first time ever, we're having a huge number, almost one-third of new college grads are coming back into the nest. And so this issue of at what point do you cut off that economic umbilical cord is huge. And so the one message that I want to give to all the moms in the room, because I have seen this over and over again, is that sometimes the most loving thing you can do for your children, especially as they start to get out of the house, is to help them develop a plan to get off the economic outpatient care that mom and dad are providing. And many women tell me this just feels like they're cutting off their child's hand. And what I want to say is, no, you're helping them grow a whole new skill set by doing this. So if you are in the fortunate position that you have extra assets, trusts can be a wonderful thing to set up because you can define how your kids will access that money and so forth. But the first level that I think is the most important thing is to know that sometimes saying no is the most loving form of financial empowerment you can give your children.
Good words. Thank you. Because I've heard you speak on this before, so it sounds like you don't have to be wealthy to have a trust, but if you have kids under age 18, you probably want to be the one to decide custodianship versus the state. So always a good plan. Okay, so we heard about some myths, Manisha. Any guideposts or truths that you stick to and coach to?
Yeah, so Kelly knows this. I love simple rules of thumb. I've never been able to remember complex formulas in my head, and I just like little nuggets that I can use as a touchstone. And Kelly also knows that I aspire to have a body like Kelly's. Instead, I have a size 10 body that is wrapped tightly in Spanx today.
I have Spanx. I have Spanx on.
No.
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. All right. Spanx works for women of all sizes and shapes. And one of the things that I find is I don't always eat the way I should, but I have a mental frame of reference. When my sugar content is off the charts, I can at least remember the food pyramid or the dinner plate, and I'm cognizant of what I'm doing. But when it comes to your spending, most of us have no idea what healthy spending looks like. So of all the tips that I share today, I think this one is the most life-transforming. Not the most fun, but the most life-transforming. And it's 50-30-20. If you think about your total income, roughly in an ideal world, if you're engaging in balanced spending, roughly 50% of your pay, your income, household income, would go towards needs, which would be defined as your home, your car, food, mandatory child care. 30% would go towards wants, which is all the fun stuff. And then this is the part where people are thinking, I don't like that speaker. 20% goes towards savings. And that's ideal. Just, again, like ideal, one day I would suddenly look like Kelly. And the issue that I want to say, it's where you're heading. In the savings component, ideally, you would save 20% of your income, but life isn't always ideal. So when you are paying off debt, I include debt pay down in that 20% formula. Because when you are paying off credit card debt, student loan debt, what you are doing is saving yourself interest. So if you can think about the mix that way, if funds are feeling tight, and it's the rare person I meet who for whom the answer to our funds feeling tight isn't yes, take a look at your spending and see which of the areas you are oversized in. Oftentimes, it will be home or needs, and you'll suddenly realize, wow, when I add up my rent or my mortgage payment and my property tax and my insurance and my maintenance and my upkeep, my home is eating up 40% of my income, in which case now you have 60% less for all that other stuff, transportation, food, etc. So this formula, 50-30-20, I'm happy to say, was created by a woman, a really awesome woman. She's now a senator, Elizabeth Warren. She's done amazing work on behalf of the American population in terms of trying to improve setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the genesis of this, importantly, was when she was a lawyer at Harvard Law School, a law professor at Harvard Law School, studying bankruptcies. What she found was that typically the number one cause of bankruptcy is not people spending like a crazy person. It's life spitting in your eyeball in the form of an unanticipated medical expense. But the secondary contributing factor was unbalanced spending prior to that. So we can't always control the medical factor, but the balanced spending is something we can. So if you can walk away and just know that's your financial food pyramid, 50-30-20, 50% towards the things you have to have, 30% of your spending towards wants, 20% is savings, and that includes 401k, 403b, IRA, your emergency fund, plus debt pay down, the credit card payments you're making, the student loan payments you're making, all of that. That rough rule of thumb for many people is the aha light in terms of seeing where you want to start your joy maximization budgeting activities.
Okay, so more than likely we've all thought about budgeting. I see a lot of note-taking. You're inspiring us. We're empowered. How can we make this tangible? What's the next step when we leave and go back home? How do we track it? How do we do this?
So there are basically two different patterns that you can use. One is really old-fashioned and simple, and it's the one I use, and I will literally show it to you. Hang on 1 second. This is my wallet. There's a little slip in the back where I keep a piece of paper. And I literally, at the point that I am spending money, I'm writing a bill, I'm paying something online, I'm literally at the grocery counter. I whip this out and I write down what I just spent money on. So just spent $4 on coffee, $24 on personal supplies, $100 cleaning lady, $30 dry cleaning, $102 grocery. So literally, I just write it down. And at the end of the month, I tally it up. It takes me no more than 15 minutes. I'm kind of odd because I've been doing this since 1991. It brings me extreme pleasure. But let me tell you why you might want to try and do something like this. I've had jobs in the past that have made me just miserable to my core. I've met the most incredible man of my life that made me want to change paths and work in a different way.
And can we point Randy out, by the way? He's the debonair gentleman right
there. He's a really handsome man in the corner. What I found is having this financial knowledge, and I literally just tally it up in a spreadsheet. And when I first started doing it, I kept it pen and paper. What those numbers let you do is know if you are in a bad relationship, a bad job, and you want to get into a better situation, exactly what you need in order to move forward. It's really valuable data. Now, if seeing what I do makes you want to vomit, and for most people that is usually the response, you don't have to do it pen and paper. I just bring that up because not everybody likes the modern solutions. There are wonderful apps out there. You can use Mint.com, which will let you aggregate your accounts online. So this can all be automated for you. There are sites like Hello Wallet is an excellent one, similarly, that will help you track. And now we're moving into the next generation. So the original sites would aggregate your data and then spit it out with pie charts and show you the different categories. But there's a new company in beta. It's called Movin, MOVEN.com. And theirs goes one step beyond where you can program in your problem areas of spending. It might be mani-pedis. It might be coffees. It might be drinks out. Whatever your area is, you can put it in, and it will track. You use their debit card, and so you're paying the money off in full. And as you get close to your spending limit on a certain category, it texts you and it sends you an email and it asks, like, do you really want to do this? And so So you can really do this budgeting thing in a wide spectrum. But the thing that I want you to know about this is you're not doing this to be punitive to yourself. You're doing this for two reasons. One is, I promise you, you will look down your spending and find at least 5 to 7 items in any given month that you spent money on that did not make you happy. And so there you can cut costs and not cut joy. That's your goal here. The second reason, again, is those numbers are empowering. If you need to get out of a bad situation, those numbers will let you have the absolute numerical confidence to know what's the minimum set of resources you need to move forward. So while it may not be the most fun thing, I highly encourage doing this, even if it's just for a month, so that you can get a sense of where those low-hanging fruit of cost-cutting opportunities may be.
Great, a question.
And we'll repeat the question.
As we're going through and doing it, like, so husband and I have joint accounts. Money is spent separately. He really hates the online apps and everything like that. I'm fine with them, so I think that the writing it down would be great. Guidance on how, when you're trying to combine very separate spending habits, because sometimes he does the grocery shopping, sometimes I do it. We both work full-time, so we both share house management responsibilities.
So I think the easiest, would you feel comfortable owning that process for the...
And I think most everyone heard the question, but this wise woman said, up-and-coming family, 2 joint bank accounts, we're doing our own separate thing, but still, at the end of the day, we need to come together and make sure that we're not blowing ourselves up, is my summarization. But how do you have those conversations? And the how to talk money with your honey, get financially naked, is exactly what, and it talks about starting with a bottle of wine, I believe.
Right, yes, exactly. I recommend ice cream or adult beverages as the icebreaker for the conversation. And I should also just say, I literally make about 10 cents a book, so I'm not saying this from a promotional standpoint, but I believe the books are available here, and they have truly been a labor of love, because I've not been a labor of profit. And I feel like the two books contain information that I believe can transform financial lives. But this one on Get Financially Naked is directly on your question, and let me answer. So there are two pieces here. One is, why is this happening to begin with? I think that's important to know. Turns out researchers have discovered that we are genetically attracted to financial otherness in our mate. And it makes sense, because what happens in the courting stage is there's a level of intoxication that comes from experiencing oftentimes a financial behavior that is very different than our own. And that's why savers often end up marrying spenders. So the extreme example of this is, your goal is to die with exactly $1 to your name. You have maximized your spending that well. You enjoyed every last bit. Your spouse says, I don't ever want to touch principal. I just want to live on interest and dividends. So these can be really widely differing mindsets. And so how do you make it come together is one issue. And the second issue is, how do you logistically deal with the fact that you both spend in different ways? I think the simplest solution that I've seen is, for the person who doesn't like to track, have a basket when they come in the house and just ask them for one simple thing: receipts. When you come in, drop the receipt in the basket, and the person in the house that does like tracking them can, one Sunday each week, sit down with a cup of coffee and a good muffin and just go through the receipt pile and track it. That way the other person is on board and participatory, but it's not difficult for them. The other issue that this brings up is one that I think is also important, which is, what are joint expenses and what are individual expenses, and clarifying that together. And oftentimes what couples will say is, the simple fact of setting aside a dollar amount above which you both agree to consult each other before spending and or a dollar amount each month that you are each able to spend with no questions asked, those two simple things can reduce a dramatic amount of household tension. Because you each have a little freedom, plus you've got that safety bumper that nobody's going off the reservation and buying the fancy cars and the boats without you knowing. Does that help?
It helps. Keep. I think part of where we are is that we both went to track in our own ways, and we're having just a really hard time. We've been married for 9 years, so we're having a really hard time finding that common process, common ground. We both agree kind of where we want to be financially in terms of at the end goal. He is also about 10 years older than me, so I'm winning.
Which is an increasing trend. More and more of us women are the primary and co-breadwinners in our households. So another idea that I have for you is you can work with an hourly fee-based financial planner. You can find one through the Garrett Planning Network. Cheryl Garrett is a wonderful woman who founded kind of a clearinghouse for certified financial professionals that will work with people for just an hour or 2 hours. You pay them by the hour. It'll range from $100 to, in really expensive urban areas, up to maybe $250 an hour. That is a classic situation where the two of you can come in with your system and have an in-depth conversation, and an advisor could literally help you in 1 or 2 hours craft a program that you could live with. So that would be my suggestion there. Yeah, exactly. It's like a mediator.
And I recently read, you're 85% more likely to achieve goals if you have a coach. So that's one good example to have a coach. Think, and maybe in his terms, maybe it would be easier if it's a coach. But yes, thanks for the question.
So there's something called a sandwich generation.
Sandwich generation.
We have little kids, but you also have parents that are getting older. My mother, women tend to live longer, but sometimes the older generation isn't very savvy with
too far. You know what I'm thinking? I'm wondering, why don't we do this? I will weave a direct answer to that question back. Let us get back, keep going, because I'm sensing we're losing a few people. So let me keep going, and then we'll weave them back in, and then we'll end with another round of Q&A, and I can stay around afterwards to answer any additional questions. But that is an important one. How do you deal with the sandwich generation, your parents and your kids? And I will loop that into an answer.
And also my Schwab friends, Christy, Stephanie, and Stephanie, would you raise your hands? I have financial planners over here as well, if anyone would like to stay and speak to them. So help us with prioritization. We have needs. We have wants. How can we go about starting prioritizing?
So a couple rules of thumb. People will say, I need to save and I have debt. Which one do I start with first? And that is the most common question that I get. So I think about it as a cha-cha. So if you're in that situation, you are like most people. And what I would recommend first is getting a starter emergency fund of $2,000. And the reason is, in the average person's calendar year, that is the typical amount of unexpected expenses. So start by trying to save and literally just set yourself a goal. I want to do it over 12 months or 18 months, and then just do the math. How much are you going to have to save per week in order to get your $2,000 fund? Once you have that, now you can start doing this sort of tag team, where if you work for an employer who offers a match in your retirement plan at work, What you want to do is contribute at least to the point of that employer match, even if you have credit card and student loan debt. And the reason is you're getting a guaranteed return on your money, and there's nowhere you can get a guaranteed return on your money anywhere in the financial markets. So you build the starter fund. If you have an employer with a match, you do that. Then you go back and take a look at your debt. If you have any double-digit debt, and if you're like me, if you're really debt-averse, you can lower that number to any debt over 7%. Any debt over 7% and definitely any double-digit debt on credit cards or student loans, here's the formula that will, it literally melts away debt. If you have $5,000 or less in any of those forms of debt, add an extra $50 a month to the stated minimum monthly payment. And you start with a debt that has the highest interest rate. If your debt is between $5,000 and $10,000, you add an extra $100. And I mean, even if you have to work some crazy part-time gig on a weekend to get the money, it will change your life. An extra $100 a month above the minimum. And if you have more than $10,000 in debt, you'll want to add an extra $150 to the minimum monthly payment. If you do that, depending upon your interest rate, in 3 to 5 years, you will be debt-free. That is the power that comes from paying mathematically more than the minimum monthly payment. So a lot of people will say to me, I'm struggling. Should I look at debt consolidation? And my feeling is generally no. If you can do it on your own in that manner. And the best book on this subject comes from someone you may have seen on the Today Show, Jean Chatsky. She has a delightful book. It's like 10 bucks. It's called Pay It Down. And if you're struggling with debt, this book is phenomenal, and it walks through this methodology I cited. So first, you're doing the emergency fund. Then, potentially counterintuitively, you're saving for retirement. Then you are being like a ninja and adding those extra amounts to your debt. Then, after that, you can start either saving for a big ticket item, a wedding, a car, kids' college, or adding to your retirement funds. And so if you think about it in that order, and the key thing, I have a really bad habit of wanting everything to be very clear and black and white. And so what I'm saying is this is in the gray. You're doing a bit of both at the same time, saving for the future while you're paying down debt. And I just emphasize that because when you are feeling cash strapped, which most people are these days, it can just feel like a noose and you don't know where to start. And so I'm saying put a little in each area. It will make a huge difference.
And I think you've also just helped us identify, we receive the question a lot, should I pay my house down before I pay down my credit cards? And I think you're saying maybe stack the interest rates highest to lowest to see where it makes sense paying off.
Exactly. And the simple math is credit card debt oftentimes this can be anywhere from 13% to 23%. And there's nothing in the market, no stock, not even Twitter that you know with certainty over the next couple of years will give you that kind of return. So it's an amazing investment to pay down your debt. And as you think about in reverse orders, then typically you'll see next student loan, then car debt, and then usually for most people, your mortgage debt is the least expensive, and that's the reason why you're prioritizing it last versus the other more expensive forms.
Okay, thank you. Talk to us a little bit more about retirement. Many, many people fall when planning for their retirement and are not nearly prepared. We talked about that 2-to-1 ratio for even women not being prepared for retirement. Any other words of wisdom for us?
Yeah, so I feel like I'm turning this conversation into a bit of Debbie Downer gloom with my comments here. This, I promise, will be the last note that will feel like a bit of tough love, and then we will move back into a more positive realm. But retirement is a really serious issue because we are collectively this gigantic new experiment. And by that I mean up until all of us that are currently alive on the planet right now, retirement meant something really different. It meant you worked to 65 and then you died a couple years later. And so your retirement period was a couple years. If you're a woman, you lived a little longer, 5-7 years longer. But you worked for a 30 or 40 year career, and then you rested for a couple years, and then you moved on. And so Social Security plus a little bit of your own savings plus the old-fashioned kind of a retirement plan called a defined benefit plan where you work for the same company for 30 years and when you left you got a monthly check. That worked. That worked beautifully for that set of dynamics. But things have changed. I recently met a woman. Her mom was 90, speaking of the sandwich generation, 97 years old, and they never expected her to live that long, and she'd literally run out of funds. So we are going to start seeing a lot more of that. And the thing that I want you to grasp conceptually is if you think about it, if you could retire at 65 or 70, and as women, we could live well into our 90s, what that means is for every year that we work, our salaries not only have to cover our current living expenses, but potentially also a year of living expenses in retirement. And when you think about that math, that is shocking. Like never in the history of mankind have we had a situation where we were trying to fund out of 1 year's salary our current living and enough for the future. So that's why when you hear retirement numbers, they sound so staggering. So I'm going to give you the bad news and then wrap with the good news. So the bad news is there's a pretty straightforward formula that you can use to figure out how much you need to save in retirement and have absolutely zero worries if you invest sensibly in a low-cost manner. And that number is 25 times however much you think you need to spend to maintain your retirement. So let me give you an example. Let's say you in retirement, most people in retirement at this point, you've paid off your mortgage, you've paid off your car, you're not working, so you don't have to pay for work clothes. And so expenses can come down, but there are things that go up. You want to spend time with grandkids, you want to travel, you want to do hobbies. So let's say you think about it and you say, you know what, I'm going to need $50,000 a year to maintain my household standard of living. And I've worked all these years and paid into Social Security, my spouse has. And so we have $25,000 of Social Security that will be coming in between us. So we need to spend $50,000, $25,000 is coming in, but I need something to help make up that other difference, that extra $25,000. The math is you would multiply that residual by 25 times to come up with the target nest egg that you would have. So in this example, $25,000 times 25 is $625,000. So that is the number if at age 65 you wanted to retire and you expected to live to 95 and you never wanted to have to cut your spending. You were able to spend $50,000 a year consistently. And so for most people, it's like, okay, what planet do you live on? Like, where is that going to happen? So there are two answers. One, for those of you in the room that are in your 20s and 30s, it's actually incredibly doable. If you can save $5,000 a year starting in your 20s, and it'll be a stretch in your 20s, but if you force yourself to do that, and you do that throughout your working years, by the time you're 65, you'll have $1 million. $5,000 a year saved from 25 to 65, earning 7% a year, is $1 million. So if you are on the young end listening to these numbers, the best thing you can do is sock away the maximum you can in a retirement plan. For those of us that are outside our 20s and 30s and our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond, what can you do? This is, again, where small steps can have a huge difference. If you're willing to have a little bit of fluctuation in your spending, those numbers come down dramatically. The 25 times the spending number is the number that says you never have to change your pattern. If you are willing to adjust your spending when there are bad years in the markets, you spend a little bit less. If you're willing to take a little bit of part-time work the first 5 to 10 years of retirement, the numbers can drop dramatically to 15 times what you need to spend. And so the way I think about it, it's like root touch-up. So you go and get your hair colored, and it costs a lot. And then after 3 weeks, this happens to me, I start getting the skunk line. And so a root touch-up, and you go to the drugstore and get the Clairol Easy Brush on, and suddenly you've got another 3 weeks out of your hair color. And the root touch-up is the financial version of being willing to spend a little less or work a little more. It will dramatically extend the length that you will be able to joyfully live off your retirement. So there's good news and bad news in that. The bad news is it is a huge sum of money. The reason is because we live so much longer. But you have control, flexibility on the spending, the willingness to work a little bit more in retirement and something part-time that brings you joy can really make the numbers work out.
Thank you. So we have a remaining few minutes. I'm going to start with a statistic that you and I know well. In 2010, women became accountable for 50% of the private wealth in the United States. Can we just give a little applause for that, and maybe a hoot or a holler? So we see the trend, women coming into their own, either they've inherited it, you're earning it on your own, you're a sandwich generation recipient. So our message to you is don't feel like you need to be in the dark about retirement planning, legacy planning, investing. Where can we go to? Is it expensive to get a financial advisor? What sources? We live in a pretty transparent world. Mm-hmm.
So this is what I say. The financial services industry is oftentimes can feel a step up from buying a car. Like you walk in and you think, okay, how are you going to be taking me for a ride? Because you oftentimes don't understand what you're being charged or what's going on. So I have a couple pieces of advice. I am a huge fan, and I am genuinely not saying this because I'm standing up here with Kelly, of firms like Charles Schwab that have a long history of low-cost, honest, straightforward, highly compliant, supervised advice. And so at nearly any level of starting out, you can talk to somebody. And one of the things that I love is if you're just starting out, you can talk at a large quality firm like this to somebody who's working on a salaried basis. And so you can feel like we're having an honest dialogue and you're not trying to sell me something. Another place that you can go to get good financial information to get good financial advice is to start self-educating. And so there are a couple of books. If you are in the retirement stage, I would say the best $12 you can spend is on a little book called Can I Retire? Written by a CPA named Michael Piper, who is wise beyond his years. He's in his late 20s, but it is the single best book I have ever read on how to plan for retirement. And reading that book and then talking to a financial professional at a larger firm can be really empowering. The other piece of advice that I would give is I find that the thing that keeps people from seeking out financial advice more often than not is the issue of what is it going to cost me. And so I just wanted to encourage you, never feel any embarrassment about asking that question. My favorite litmus test for talking to a financial professional is to say, have you say to them, explain to me your fee structure. Any other service you'd buy, you'd want to know the price. It should be no different and even more important because it's your money. And so if the person can't stare you in the eye and give a complete, transparent, simple answer, that is a huge red flag to move on. And the last thing I'll just say is just to know that for better or worse, the financial services industry is a little bit like healthcare in that pricing can be different in different places. So there can be I want to just wrap by telling you the couple of types of fees you want to look out for. If you are working with somebody who is not on salary, they may charge you a percent of assets under management. They may charge you a flat fee to work with them, or they may charge you commissions. And so you just want to ask which of the three they are doing. Next up, there are other levels of fees. Once the financial professional helps you decide what to invest in, the investments themselves may also have fees associated with them. So the professional may say you should buy this mutual fund or this ETF or this investment vehicle, and you want to know what are the expense ratios, is the term, associated with the investments. And so by asking the two levels, what you want in an ideal world, I would argue, is for both fees together not to be more than 1.5%. And if that's the case, you're in pretty darn good shape. And so I just want to say, don't ever hesitate to ask, what are your fees? And I think that will eliminate a huge reason why so many of us women in particular, very understandably, don't like to seek out financial advice. I'll end with a stat. 70% of women say they would like to work with a financial professional. Only 20% of women do, according to Cerulli. And the reason, I really think, is a combination of the fact that a lot of the ads and things we see in the industry make finance sound like it's some kind of war game, mm-hmm. and so it doesn't feel appealing, and this issue of fees, which now you can own and ask. So,
and in support of that, Manisha, the person should not be bedazzling you with complexities. You can tell the person to speak to you in lay terms. That the person should be helping to demystify you. And as we said, we're in a very transparent world now. So feel free to go online and do your own research about fees with mutual funds, whether it be the Charles Schwab site or any other site or your neighbor's site that you want to go on. That's the good news, that you can be empowered before you go on. So we have covered so much terrain here, Manisha, and so valuable. So I know you're staying around a little bit. Christy and Stephanie, myself, and another Stephanie will also be around. So I'd like to thank you. Any last words?
Yeah, you know, the last thing I'll just say is while in my day job, I manage money for a very specific niche. One of the things that I've always tried to maintain, my website is moneyzen.com, and I always maintain a page called resources, and I update it constantly. It is what I think, wearing my financial literacy advocacy hat, are the most powerful books, magazines, websites, and links that can help women own their finances. So if you check out the resource page, and I have no affiliation with anybody that's on there, it's just genuinely, when somebody reaches out to me and they don't have $1 million and I want to try and help, I created this page to be a place where people could go and get started on the self-education process. So I encourage you to own your financial well-being and to really think about the process of managing your money as maximizing your joy. Remember the 50-30-20 rule, and know that the Joneses are probably broke, and that's going to send you off in a great direction.